ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hi, this is Mike Behe, Senior Fellow with Discovery Institute. In 1996, I kicked over the hornet's nest with my book, Darwin's Black Box, and Discovery Institute has been there for me ever since. They've been there for a lot of us, and you make that possible by your financial support for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery Institute needs your help now more than ever. Please consider giving a donation today to support the Scholars of Intelligent Design. To give, go to discovery.org/CSC2021. That's discovery.org/CSC2021. Thanks very much.
Hello, this is Eric Anderson, and today I'm joined again by Dr. Michael Behe to continue our conversation about his brand new book, A Mousetrap for Darwin. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks very much, Eric. It's always great to be with you.
So for any who may be just joining us, we're talking about your new book, A Mousetrap for Darwin, which is a collection of responses to critics of your first three books, Darwin's Black Box, The Edge of Evolution, and Darwin Devolves. I would encourage any listeners who may be joining us for the first time to go back and listen to our prior discussions, as we've laid some important groundwork about the arguments you've made over the years, the state of the science, and the key differentiating point of what evolution really needs to explain if it is to be taken seriously as a useful theory of origins. And you've also shared with us how to analyze irreducibly complex systems based on your example of a mousetrap, and we've talked a little bit about the bacterial flagellum. Now I want to delve into another remarkable system that you've brought to the fore in the debate over evolution and intelligent design, and that's the blood clotting cascade. First, Mike, tell us what you mean by the blood clotting cascade, and how was it that you came to recognize this as an example of irreducible complexity?
Well, the blood clotting seems to be pretty simple. You know, a guy goes in the morning to shave, and you kind of nick your face, and it bleeds a little, slows down, and stops. You know, what's the big deal? But it turns out that scientists have shown that even such an apparently simple thing has dozens of different parts. And the key fact is that it has to be controlled very tightly, because if blood clots at the wrong time or in the wrong place, you could have heart attack, strokes. And so it's a very sensitive system.
Right. So there's several parts that have to come together and work together. And it's not the existence of this, but rather your contention is that the blood clotting cascade is irreducible, that it poses a challenge to Darwinian evolution. And a number of outspoken critics have attacked your argument. We'll review some of these today. Tell us first about Russell Doolittle.
Sure. Russell Doolittle is a prominent scientist. He's a professor of biochemistry at the University of California, San Diego. He's been retired for a while, and he's a member in the National Academy of Sciences. And he's worked pretty much his whole career on the blood clotting cascade. And soon after I wrote Darwin's Black Box, he wrote an essay in which he said that I was incorrect and that the blood clotting cascade can work with reduced number of parts.
Yeah, and I'm guessing this was another one of these times when you thought, oh, shoot, maybe I've missed something somewhere in the literature. Here's the world's foremost expert telling me I'm wrong. But as you looked into it, what did you find?
Well, it was interesting. He gave some reasons for the validity of evolution, which I was very familiar with, and did not present any problems for my argument. But then he pointed to a brand new research result that had just come out soon after he was planning on writing his essay. And he says, you know, this paper said that the removal of fibrinogen rescues mice from the symptoms of plasminogen deficiency. Now, fibrinogen and plasminogen are parts of the clotting cascade. And he said, look, mice missing one or the other of these factors have big problems. But if you take away two of those, both of them at the same time, then they're normal. And so this shows that the blood clotting cascade could be formed in steps of two, perhaps, or or something. He didn't actually go on to say how that was relevant, but he said this shows that it's not irreducibly complex. And it would be an interesting result, but it turned out to be wrong. He misread the paper.
Okay. So what was the actual situation with those mice in that study when they were missing both of those?
Well, plasminogen is a protein that goes on to clear blood clots after their job has been done. So if a clot forms in a vein to stop some leakage or something, it comes along and removes it. And if it is missing, which these researchers, they produced mice that were missing this factor, then they can't clear clots. And the clots stick around and they gum up the circulatory system. They have big problems. On the other hand, the researchers also knocked out or eliminated fibrinogen. And fibrinogen is the material of the clot itself. It's kind of the strands of a net that stops blood from flowing. And if they knocked that out, then the mice's blood couldn't clot, and they would bleed and hemorrhage, and again, they'd have lots of problems.
Right. So he was saying it's wonderful when we also knock out fibrinogen, because then they don't have any more clots, right, that are going to cause problems.
that's right. Yeah. So the researchers said, well, if you knock out fibrinogen, then mice don't have the problems they have missing only plasminogen. But it turns out they don't have those problems, but they have all the problems that mice missing just fibrinogen have. That is, they don't have a functioning clotting system. They bleed, female mice die during pregnancy. They've got severe problems. And the reason is simple enough to understand. Plasminogen, its job is to remove clots once their job is done. So if you can't do that and you've got clots, then your blood is all gummed up. But fibrinogen is the clot material itself. So if you're missing fibrinogen, you don't need plasminogen to remove a clot.
And you're already in trouble.
Yeah. So your blood doesn't get gummed up. That's the good side, but you bleed to death, and that's the bad side.
Yeah. So that sounds like it didn't quite work as a refutation of your,
no.
your argument.
He kind of airily acknowledged it when I brought it to his attention, but he thought that, that doesn't really matter because I have all these other cool arguments like about hemoglobin and other things, which I already had showed don't work. And that was the only new thing. And I think this is really a significant point because Russell Doolittle was pretty much the world's authority on blood clotting. Instead of just pointing to a paper where it is explained how blood clotting could have developed by Darwinian means, he points to a paper about hemorrhaging mice. And so that shows that there is no explanation for the origin of the blood clotting cascade or for anything similarly complex.
Yeah. But this still gets cited, doesn't it? I mean, there's critics out there who still say, oh, Doolittle responded to Mike Behe and took care of it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, everybody seems to read the critics and then nobody reads my responses. So that's why A Mousetrap for Darwin is a necessary book.
Yeah, exactly. That's why we've got this great new book. Well, good. So I have to tell you a personal story. So I have factor V Leiden, which is a mutation of one of the clotting factors in the blood, one of the factors, I should say. And this mutation can increase a person's chance of developing abnormal blood clots, most commonly in the legs or lungs. Are you familiar with factor V Leiden?
Yes, I am. Yeah, it's relatively common. It's a mutation that is a simple mutation called a point mutation, which changes an arginine to a glutamine. And that doesn't sound like a big deal, but it turns out that makes it longer lived in the body. And it isn't removed as fast as it should be by another factor called protein C. And that leads to increased activity, which means you clot more frequently or more strongly than you otherwise would.
Right. And so just for the listeners, what happens is this protein factor C?
Yeah, protein C.
Yeah. So that cleaves, meaning cuts the factor 5 at the arginine site. And when that's missing, then the cleavage happens with less regularity. Mm-hmm. And so it ends up leaving the clots in place a little bit more often than it should. And, you know, as you look at this, it's been years since I researched this, but I took a quick look at it last night just to remind myself. So this factor 5 works together with factor 8 to activate prothrombin to thrombin, which then, of course, kicks in the fibrinogen to fibrin, which creates the clot. And so what's happening is that this factor 5 is not being eliminated as quickly from the blood as it should be, you know, when there's enough clotting already going on. And so this amplification of the clotting process is continuing more than it should. And so for me, you know, you have, I think in one of your books, maybe it was in Darwin's Black Box, you have this Rube Goldberg kind of example where you start from one end and you go all the way through the Rube Goldberg, which is a really great example. But I think it's important for listeners to understand that with the blood clotting cascade, we're not just dealing with a Rube Goldberg in the sense that I kick off something at the beginning and there's lots of fun steps and then we end up with something at the end. There are actually control processes on the side chains. There are ways that this process is carefully governed and turned off and turned on at the right time and in the right place and in the right way and to the right extent. And so all of this has to be there together and happen together rather than just say, well, you know, I'm kicking over one domino and I'm going to get one result at the end. It's a very controlled process that has to be in place here.
Absolutely. And it's a very finely balanced system. A little too much blood clotting and you've got problems. A little too little blood clotting and you've got other problems. So it has to be optimized from the start or it causes trouble.
Right. And another thing that we had talked about the other day in terms of the critics is that some say, you know, gee, if X doesn't work right, then you die. But that's not necessarily your argument. So for example, lots of people, as you mentioned, have the factor 5 Leiden mutation. Doesn't mean we're going to go out and die tomorrow, but it means that there is a problem in the system where there's an additional risk factor that's involved. And the system is carefully constructed enough, we might say, that this one mutation doesn't throw the entire thing out the window, but it does impact the amplification phase and it impacts the control. So that we have to be a little more careful and, you know, let our doctor know if we're going in for surgery that, hey, I've got this this mutation, you might want to watch for it.
Absolutely.
So let's move next to Ken Miller's proposal. He was one of the very strong critics, spent a lot of time challenging your ideas from Darwin's Black Box and your other books. When you had his paragraph, I guess, from his book that you quoted about his proposal for the blood clotting cascade and how it came about. And I have to tell you, Mike, I literally laughed out loud when I read his proposal. It was just comical.
Yeah, it wasn't what you call a real detailed proposal.
Yeah. So walk us through Miller's attempt to explain away this challenge for Darwin's theory.
Well, first thing you have to realize is that it's just a thought experiment. And he says, well, suppose we start with an organism, it didn't have a blood clotting cascade, but then if it got injured, then its blood would be in contact with some fluid from cells, and maybe there would be a factor inside the cell that could non-specifically cut some of the blood proteins, and that would cause them to aggregate and essentially gum up the circulatory system and maybe stop bleeding at a particular spot. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So that's a starting, point.
Yeah. Yeah, an unspecified factor that works in an unidentified way that may or may not do something helpful. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you can of course think that might make it worse for the organism rather than better, but that doesn't slow them down. No, he then goes on to say, well, maybe this protein could then be targeted to the blood by having some signal in DNA accidentally be copied next to the gene for that factor to export it into the blood. And he says, then it just kind of hung around for, you know, a million years or so. But if you have this non-specific enzyme that degrades protein just floating in the blood, that's an extremely dangerous situation. It's uncontrolled. It could mess a lot of things up. Then he says, well, you know, maybe then it acquired the ability to cut proteins when a blood vessel was ruptured. But in current organisms, the factors of the blood clotting cascade have to stick exactly at the site of the injury in order to do their job. And in his scenario, that's ignored. So essentially, he doesn't treat the problem seriously. He dreams up complex starting points. He doesn't attend to the regulation. He just assumes every step will be helpful. We all know that Darwinists are famous for just so stories. I would characterize this as not even a very good just so story. So it's really just ignoring the problems rather than trying to see how they can be solved.
Yeah. It was just a made up story. And I was struck, you know, you kept referring to this would be favored by natural selection. Natural selection would do that. And, you know, that's not an explanation. That's just a restatement of the theory. I mean, we know what the theory says, that natural selection is going to do all these wonderful things, but that doesn't mean you've actually given us an explanation. Yeah. You just restated your theory.
And the interesting thing is that Ken Miller is not an expert on blood clotting. Russell Doolittle was the expert on blood clotting. So Miller doesn't know anything that Doolittle didn't already know. And as we've talked about, Russell Doolittle, you know, had no idea how the clotting cascade could have arisen, but that didn't stop Ken Miller.
Yeah. So I like that you noted this was really not a serious attempt to contribute to our understanding of the blood clotting cascade. This was just, trying to convince the readers, circle their wagon. If the readers aren't familiar with the details of the blood clotting cascade, this is just an attempt to say, hey, we've got it under control. Darwinism hasn't answered. Nothing to see here, folks. Move along.
Exactly. It's interesting. And this goes to the need for A Mousetrap for Darwin, the new book, because when my more recent book, Darwin Devolves, was published in 2019, it was reviewed in Science. Got a hostile review in Science. And in the review, they said that Behe doubles down on the blood clotting cascade, because I talked in the appendix about how it hasn't been explained. And they said he doesn't even mention Ken Miller's really great explanation for how it could arise. They say, oh, holy moly, these things function not to actually explain things. They just function as things that Darwinists could wave at or point to deflect criticism.
Yeah. Just completely oblivious to what's really required from an engineering standpoint to build this system and just kind of sweeping it under the rug. Mm-hmm. So lastly, Mike, tell us about Keith Robison's proposal.
Sure. Yeah. Back when Darwin's Black Box came out about a year or two later in the late 90s, there was a graduate student then named Keith Robison. And he said, well, here's how you can develop a cascade. He didn't talk directly about the blood clotting cascade, but he says, you know, suppose we've got a protein and it has several different activities. It can activate itself and it can activate another protein. And then the gene for it duplicates, he said, and now it either copy of the gene, either protein, it's the same thing. So they can activate each other and both work on the downstream protein that they're supposed to be working on. Notice that this is his starting point, which is already pretty complex and which already has elements of a cascade in it. And then he says, well, maybe the gene for the first protein loses its ability to activate the downstream target protein. He says, well, that'd be neutral. Nobody would care about that because the other protein could still do that and they could still activate each other. Well, okay, but suppose that the second gene now loses its ability to activate itself. So it has to be activated by the first one, which activates the second one, which can then work on the downstream protein. But that's neutral too. So as I wrote in my response, which is included in A Mousetrap for Darwin, he's actually guiding the process to where he wants it to go. All of the steps that he proposed, or none of the steps he proposed, are helpful in themselves. He has to get four very specific changes in an initially complex system in order to get it further down. And it's only happening because he's using his intelligence to direct the system towards the target that he wants. And again, all of this was just theoretical. It was just words on paper. There were absolutely no experiments to flesh it out.
Yeah. So tell us what you mean by he was guiding it. You mean in the thought experiment, he's guiding it, and he's guiding it because these are theoretically neutral. There's no ability for natural selection to help the process along. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's exactly right. He says, well, he has a target in mind. I need to get a new step in a cascade. So how can I do it? I know if I take the system over to the left and then take it a step up and then to the right and down and around these obstacles, I can get to where I want to go. But that of course, is intelligent direction. And actually, here's an important point for the listeners to know, and that is that if you want to tune a blood clotting system, suppose you are in circumstances where it would be favorable for the clotting cascade to work more quickly, or other circumstances to make it work more slowly. The easiest way to do that is not to duplicate a gene and wait a million years until something like Keith Robison or even Ken Miller were talking about. The easiest way to do that is if you needed the system to work faster, you can just degrade a factor that slows the system down. And if you need it to work slower, you can just degrade a factor that makes it work at its current pace. So it's a whole lot easier and faster to adjust the system by degrading it than it would be by adding a whole new factor into it. And that's something that these guys don't even consider.
Sure. And then it might look like it's doing what you want in that immediate circumstance. But from an engineering standpoint, you've now lost control. You've lost some guiding information. You've lost.
That's right.
Some of the finesse of the control of the system that previously existed.
That's right.
So this gene duplication thing seems to be a very popular approach to answering any criticisms of Darwinism. You kind of throw gene duplication out there. What's going on with this gene duplication and the neutral evolution?
Yeah, well, the idea is this, that if you have a gene for a protein that does something, well, during replication of a cell, say when you're making a new organism, the processes that make more DNA, that duplicate the DNA you have, sometimes they go awry. It's very good, the processes that duplicate DNA, but they can make mistakes. And so maybe a region that contains this gene is copied twice. And so now you've got a piece of DNA that has two copies of that gene. And usually that situation is thought to be blah. It doesn't help. It doesn't hurt. If you've got two genes for the same thing, that's considered to be neutral. Again, it doesn't hurt or help. But in people's imagination, well, now maybe one of the copies of the gene can undergo a mutation, and maybe that'll give it a different property, and maybe that'll be helpful. Then another mutation might come along to help it even further. So again, in people's imaginations, this is a way for them to speculate about how similar proteins could be built up over time. But if you look at it closely, again, like Keith Robison, they're invoking multiple neutral steps, which is not a Darwinian scheme, really. And it's likely to take a very long time, and it's likely to not even happen.
Yeah, so it's falling back to sheer dumb luck and abandoning natural selection, which is supposed to be the great savior of the evolutionary story. I mean, it turns the you know, natural selection, the whole reason Darwin proposed it was supposed to turn the random into the direction, the purposeless into the purposeful, because no one takes the idea seriously that a complex, sophisticated system could come about just by sheer dumb luck.
Exactly.
So you're kind of falling back to that. And then, of course, at the end of the process, they revert to Darwin and say, well, once we got this great system built by sheer dumb luck, then we need Darwin to help preserve it and spread it around.
Right. Yeah. So like once you build a car, all you need is a key and you'll turn it and that's a selectively, you know, helpful step.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we end up with something we talked about previously, which is, you know, the waiting time problem in a neutral situation. And as you wrote in the book, when the improbability of a pathway exceeds the available probabilistic resources, then we have to rule out Darwinism and look toward design as a more reasonable explanation.
Yes, that's exactly right. If a mutation which helps build a system isn't reasonably probable, and you have to strain for improbable events, then you're leaving behind the Darwinian idea of building things by regular random processes plus natural selection.
And with the blood clotting cascade, again, we're not dealing with one or two of these factors that have to come together. We're talking about dozens of things that work in just the right way and just the right amount to make this a successful system. So, Mike, what's the bottom line for the evolutionary explanations of the cascade?
Well, now it's been nearly 25 years since I pointed out the problems, and there is still no reasonable evolutionary Darwinian explanation for the clotting cascade. It's still a wonderful example of irreducible complexity. And because of how it's constructed so intricately and for such a clear purpose, it's a very strong pointer toward design.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Mike, for being here again today to help us better understand some of these remarkable systems we find throughout biology.
Sure, my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ID the Future. For more information about the essential issues raised by Dr. Michael Behe and his lively and insightful responses to critics, get your copy of A Mousetrap for Darwin today in paperback or ebook format at online retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Until next time, for ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.